Hi, my name is Lowell, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Simon Fraser Campus Radio.
Would you give me a beat?
CJSF 90.1 FM is the campus radio station for Simon Fraser University, located on Burnaby Mountain in BC, Canada. CJSF 90.1 FM, diverse, independent, yours. Check us out on SoundCloud or at cjsf.ca.
Hello there, and welcome to this week's episode of the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host for today, Hale, and with me is Aaron, Kira, and Brandon. So today we have a, I guess, dark philosophical topic. Needless to say, interesting, complicated, obscure, often talked about still, though, still very relevant in many ways. We're discussing fascism. So for our listeners today, this is kind of a mix of a philosophy, history, political science episode. What is this major political movement with a lot of disturbing actions associated with it? I think probably the first thing to say that I'll throw out there both to my co-host and to you listener is that probably more so than any major political ideology, fascism is difficult to talk about because it's very difficult to nail down. Does not have a clear ideological basis, particularly materially, economically, you know, the kind of theories that we associate with the alternative political ideologies, the main ones such as various Marxist ideologies and obviously various liberal capitalist ideologies. It kind of lacks a lot of that. And that in some ways makes it very unique. I was talking with Brandon, one of our co-hosts, before the show, and we were discussing how perhaps more than any other large political movement or ideology, fascism is one that is deeply historical. And what we were kind of getting at by agreeing on that point was that Marxist ideologies, obviously capitalist ideologies, whether it be liberalism, neoliberalism, whatever it might be, there's a component of ahistoricism to them. And for our listeners, what I mean by that is that they're transferable, right? Different societies, different places, and different times can take up the basic mantle of this theory and institute it. Marxism is perhaps the most obvious, right? We see Marxism pop up or Marxism popped up all over the world in very different cultures and societies trying to institute this, obviously in very unique and different ways, but that core was still there. Whereas fascism is an ideology that seems deeply rooted and associated with particular people at a particular moment in time. And that moment in time is generally the first half of the 20th century. At the end of the show, we'll probably talk about a little bit about what fascism is like today, what it really means in today's world. But when we actually talk about fascist movements, we're going to be talking about a very specific time and place. And so to really get right into it, I'll let everyone jump in a second. But for our listeners, in case you didn't know, there's really only two uncontroversially fascist states in history. And even as I say that, one of them actually is controversial, whether or not it's fascist-ish. I actually don't think it's that controversial, but people make controversies out of it. And that's fascist Italy, run by particularly by Benito Mussolini from about 1922 to 1945, depending on how you look at it. And then obviously Nazi Germany is perhaps the kind of paradigm of fascist states. And we'll get into why that is, obviously with Adolf Hitler as dictator from 1933 to 1945. And so those are the two really clear ones. It's important to say that there have been other movements that have been associated and have been fascist-like, but none have really encapsulated fascism in whatever its odd ideology is, as best as we'll parse it out in this episode, to a really full degree, have really embraced the ideology. So before we go any further, why don't I open up the floor a little bit, see if any of my co-hosts have anything to say, add, as we kind of jump into this topic?
I guess, because we're talking a bit about what fascism is as a kind of in an introductory way. So I prepared for this show by reading Hannah Arendt's work, The Origins of Totalitarianism. So immediately there already is this question of, okay, well, we've got these two names, fascism and totalitarianism. In Arendt's work, she treats the two main totalitarian states, Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. And I would, my immediate question is, well, the fascist term obviously applies to Nazi Germany because it, and I think for the reason, and this is me going with my intuitions more or less, because now we've got fascist Italy in the picture. It seems to be because there is a dictatorial head of state, that there is a leader, there is Mussolini and there is Hitler. Stalin is playing a similar role in a totalitarian way, sort of organizing everything in a certain totalitarian fashion, obviously. But the dictatorial role of Stalin, I'm just, again, bumping up against my intuitions here, it seems to be a bit different. Stalin, at least imagistically, is not a dictator in the same way that Hitler and Mussolini might have been. And maybe that's one reason for not necessarily including the Soviet Union in a fascist label. But they're going into what makes Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union similar. There's a lot of similarities and we'll get into those. But again, I'm just bringing up this question of, okay, well, if we're going to talk about fascism, here's kind of a question of, well, where does the line get drawn? And is it useful to draw the line there, et cetera?
Yeah, and I think that's a great thing to bring up, Brandon, because obviously there have been many dictators throughout history. History, unfortunately, has no shortage of dictators. And they share many attributes. But what's the difference, you know, between, say, is you're talking about the Soviet Union, which absolutely was a paradigm case of a totalitarian state, versus Nazi Germany, let's say, which was also a paradigm case of a totalitarian state. But why is one ostensibly communist and the other, you know, fascist? And I think that, therefore, that's a great place to jump in to talk about what are some of the key features of fascism? Because as I said at the beginning, fascism is a notoriously hard ideology to nail down. As soon as I started jumping into any kind of literature, whether it be stuff on YouTube, reading some books, articles, whatever, one of the first things that always comes up is scholars talking about how no one can really agree on what fascism is. There is no broad agreement. But there are some key features. There's some stuff that continually pop up. And so we can talk about them. We can put them right out there. So the first and probably the most obvious and absolutely key is ultranationalism. These are movements that are deeply rooted in a sense of national identity, and particularly oftentimes it related to that, and this is again getting the historical component, national rejuvenation. The point of fascism is to keep, and this is where things get like a little technical and a little weird. I'm going to try and press as best I can. Part of what makes fascism is this kind of internalized revolution. This is one of the complexities of fascism, because a lot of people call it a revolutionary movement. A lot of people say it's deeply conservative, that it's very reactionary. But what's definitely going on is this sort of internal rejuvenation, where this sort of idea collective of the nation, of the people, whatever that is, if it's even a real thing, is like both staying the same and transitioning to something better at the same time. But by the very feature of keeping the most key and inherent features. So unlike other revolutionary movements at the time, Marxist movements, let's talk about the Russian Revolution for a second, where you basically had an entire society deconstruct itself, you have in fascist movements, you have a veneration of certain institutions, of practices, of cultures, and keeping those forward, but like reusing them in new and unique ways to create a kind of new concept of people that is aspiring to something greater. You can already hear a little bit. And so you have that kind of internal revolution going on. Another point of fascism, which is kind of obvious but needs to be stated, is dictatorship. Fascism generally looks to a, it does universally look to a strongman, to some kind of dictator to lead the people, to embody the people. It is most definitely anti-democratic. And so you have this, and there's a lot of these weird contradictions going on in fascism, which again makes it such a hard ideology to understand or talk about, because on the one hand, one of the contradictions of fascism is very anti-democratic, yet it's all based around, you know, representing like the people. And so you see a lot of these sort of weird contradictions going on. Related to the dictator is a party state. This is very, very, very important. And it's particularly important to the notions of totalitarianism that Brandon will certainly talk about and bring up, wherein you fascist states, both Italy and Germany, but especially Germany, were what some callers call dual states, where you ostensibly have like the regular state apparatus that you're all familiar with. But then, you know, just behind that, or sometimes effectively right in front, you have the party apparatus. And the party apparatus actually controls and operates the state and effectively makes the state simply a facade. This was not fully realized in Italy, where the state remained relatively independent, but was absolutely realized in Nazi Germany, where the NSDAP, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, Nazi Party, absolutely controlled and obfuscated anything to do with the state. Although the state was, the important point is that the state was still there. So if you were a German or anyone else in, you know, Germany in the 1930s, let's say, you would still interact with and understand the state like we interact with and understand the state today. It's just that at any moment, that sort of reliability, that accountability that the state has could be completely undermined and ignored by the party. And very frequently was. And then the last point then is militarism. Fascist states are inherently militaristic. This relates in two different ways. One, we were talking about earlier, this historical situatedness. We can get into this a little bit more, but one of the important things to remember about, you know, the actual instantiations of fascism is that the people who brought it about were people who had been through considerable amounts of warfare, primarily in the First World War. They were all oftentimes physically, emotionally, mentally scarred by that conflict and the conflicts that preceded it. And they were deeply entrenched in militaristic ideas and goals. And that also relates to their nationalism too, because basically all fascist states have an expansionist policy. How do you, you know, improve the nation? How do you show your nation is incredible, is amazing? Well, you defeat other states. You invade other states. You take land. You take resources, all this kind of stuff. So both Italy and Germany were quite overt. Well, Germany especially was very overtly antagonistic towards other nations and other states, and was highly militaristic. So as Brandon brought up earlier, like talking about what are the key features of fascism, those are some of them. There's certainly more, but those are kind of the key things that have to be in there and don't necessarily show up in other forms of dictatorship or totalitarianism.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the distinction here between what I found in my reading was the real state, you know, the people who had the real power and who are actually making decisions that have effects on the world, and the ostensible government, the people who they leave a kind of facade up in order. It's interesting. It seems to have two purposes. One is it's a facade. You can wear the mask. You can always point to a democratically legitimate institution. But the very fact that the people understand, okay, that's not like really what's going on, that in itself is a function of having a facade of like, okay, there's two games really going on here, and I don't know who I need to listen to in any given moment. You have to make a shot call and say, okay, this institution is knocking on my door. You have to think. You can't just on trust say, like, oh, it's the government. You can't just say that. You have to make a distinction. You have to always be on your toes, explicitly deciding, okay, what am I doing? And it creates a lot of confusion. It creates confusion in every layer of society. And not only not just the layers of like civilian society, because there's this facade going on at essentially every level. Every single party is, or every single part of it is having to coordinate itself kind of almost blindly and confusedly. But that's, again, sort of the point. It creates a feeling of irreality to the whole situation, but it's conducive of a fascistic project, which, as you brought up before, is this revitalization. It can't be a stable thing because it's always in motion.
Yeah, I think that's, I really like how you said it can't be the stable thing. It's always in motion. Bringing back what we were talking about, or how I kind of introduced earlier, and Brandon especially was reminded through the kind of intentional confusion that fascist movements have, especially Nazi Germany. And with that note, I'll say to our listeners a kind of historical point. Fascism was obviously born in Italy. It was kind of the child of Mussolini and other, fascist philosophers. However, it's generally considered that fascist Italy, although authoritarian, never really reached totalitarianism. The state apparatus managed to have some kind of autonomy. Technically, Mussolini could be kicked out of power and was eventually kicked out of power through effectively legal means. And it just never really permeated society. And that's a big one. Like Nazism did. And so oftentimes Nazism is really held up as the paradigm case of fascism because you really saw the ideas of fascism come into their own and get instituted with an really obviously extreme degree of commitment. And part of that is I'm going to butcher the German phrasing, but the Gluckzeitung, which was basically an idea, which Brandon was kind of hinting at earlier, where, everything is in order, right? It actually, it roughly translates to all the circuits are on the same board. But basically what it means is that every facet of society is operating in sync with each other. And even though that might all not be super clear, and fascism was in many ways intentionally opaque in its theory and not very well thought out. Hitler was like quite open, for example, about not being super interested in theory. And if anyone's ever tried to read any Mein Kampf, which I've read a very small portion, it is virtually unreadable and very uninteresting and boring. But yeah, you basically have a society where everything is put in order. Everything is put on the same track.
I do think that if you think about the intentional confusion element of fascism, and then you add the idea, everything's supposed to be organized. We're all supposed to be like cogs in the machine. Those things seem quite contradictory, but I think it's actually intentional. That especially in Nazi Germany, there was this idea that anything that was connected with the Nazis ran like clockwork, but anything that was not connected with them was in utter confusion and chaos. And that was, I think, their entire political strategy, which was regrettably quite successful.
Yeah, and I think that kind of relates a little bit to another component of fascism, which also relates obviously to totalitarian elements, and that's the mythic element. Fascism, I actually have a really interesting quote here from Mussolini himself, where he says, "We have created a myth. This myth is a belief, a noble enthusiasm. It does not need to be reality. It is a striving and a hope, belief and courage. Our myth is the nation, the great nation, which we want to make into a concrete reality for ourselves." So, you know, fascist myths are often something that's very talked about. And obviously they're deeply ultra-nationalistic, racist, however you want to say it. But it's this point that, you know, everything that has to do with the nation and helping the nation is great and good. And anything that can be seen to getting in the way of that process or that procedure is bad. And even though there's this kind of like we're talking about, there's this weird thing going on where, like, you give people the myth first and have them believe in the myth wholeheartedly with the expectation that the myth might become some kind of reality in the future, even though you know that it's not actually real. It's always, you know, on the great horizon. And you see a very similar myth structure going on in the Soviet Union at the same time, where it's always about, like, the actual phrasing was the radiant future. You know, like, basically, like, we know today kind of sucks. Everybody's super, like, war-torn and battled and hurt and traumatized. And the economy is, like, garbage and things are not good. But, like, if you just believe and commit and show up, like, we promise a radiant future, like, tomorrow. Whether tomorrow is next year, 10, 20 years down the line. You just have to believe. You just have to be committed. And that structure was really, really integral to fascist ideology and was very clearly laid out both by Hitler and Mussolini and a lot of their ideologues as well. And I think that it relates a lot to another component of fascism that we haven't actually touched on too much, kind of obviously have hinted at it, and that's political populism. Another component of fascism that's really important is inherent in all fascist or fascist-like movements is that they are popular movements. And this is something that is actually quite different. You know, Brandon mentioned earlier in regards to totalitarianism, this is something that changed in the Soviet Union, but particularly early on during the Soviet Russian Revolution, the Soviet takeover, these were not popular movements. For example, the Soviet Union was a small clandestine group, the Bolsheviks, you know, effectively taking power through particular urban areas, but they didn't have widespread popular support. This is something very different in fascist movements, and where they gained a lot of their legitimacy and gained a lot of the legitimacy was the fact that they absolutely were populist movements. They were movements that recognized that if they are going to be successful in their mission, whatever that might be, they can't just take power. They have to have the people want them to be there, at least a large portion of them. And that is, I think, one of the key points of fascism, and it's something that is often forgotten, is that it is a movement of and by the people, even though it's a totalitarian dictatorship. I don't know, Brandon, if you have anything you want to add to this, having read Arendt.
So, I think that's actually, it's a really crucial point that fascism is essentially tied with populism, because Arendt really stresses this point that the totalitarian states, as she's calling them, we're looking for the fascism in them, but I think we can find it in that totalitarian states necessarily arise out of mass movements. Now, to have a mass movement, you have to have a mass, and a mass is a part of society, so you have to have the conditions for creating masses, and the condition for the creation of masses is the breakdown of the class system in society, specifically European society at the time, which is what adds to the kind of historicity of this phenomenon, that this is a time where class interests are no longer becoming common interests. You can't discern what people want in common with one another by citing their class interests. And this breaks down for various reasons, but essentially what this makes is a swath of people who are largely apolitical. Well, they have to be apolitical because they can't understand their common interests and act on them anymore. So they become isolated from one another. They can't, for Arendt, the capacity for political action requires cooperation. Cooperation would mean recognizing your common interests. And since we can't really know because we're not in the same class, we're just kind of an atomized individual society, we have these mass groups who don't really know what to do with each other or even themselves, because now they don't belong to anything to give them their identity. It kind of goes back and loops into that superfluousness of being identityless. You become alien in the world. So you have these mass movements, apolitical, apathetic individuals who have always kind of like been there, but who didn't form as much of the society, because now there aren't the, you know, bourgeoisie or whatever Arendt calls them, the people who are upper class and associated with ruling and whatnot. Specifically, that also comes out of the imperial era. But what happens is that these masses want to politically organize because there's people in them. You know, we are political animals, as Aristotle says. And so there is a felt need, and the certain groups of people start creating propaganda to organize those masses. They can only be organized that way because they have to be convinced of those organizers' desires to organize in a certain way or based on a certain principle. And they organize through sometimes coercion in the form of terror for fascist governments. But nonetheless, they get told what they want, and they get everything kind of organized for them. They become politically, or their interests become politically intelligible to them through a particular received structure to them. And that's what the propaganda is. So it's interesting that you say, and this was going to go back to something that you mentioned that I thought was completely right, but there's also something else to add here, that it looks like is happening is people are getting what they want, right? The leaders are just satisfying a need, but the propaganda is actually what stimulates the need first, kind of out of this ambiguous, like, oh, we want to, you know, stuff is weird, we just want to act, but we can't, so we need to know what we want to act on. Then you get your principle, oh, you want to act, you know, according to the laws of the unfolding of history in the case of the Soviet Union, or according to the survival of, you know, heredity or in Nazi Germany, some kind of genetic principle. You get that. Now it can seem like the leaders are giving them what they want. Really, it's the other way around. And the reason that this also applies to what you were saying previously is because it can seem like there is this setting of goals, but the goals aren't actually, like, any goal has a definite objective. Like, if I make a shopping list and it says get milk, once I get the milk, I can just cross it off. But the goals of a fascist state are not definable like that. You can have like political or military objectives, which have a certain definability to it, but they're never for their own sake. They're always for some kind of ideological cause that has no limit. And that's where this notion of things like world domination come in, just knowing no bounds.
Yeah, I really like a lot of what you said there, Brandon. I like one thing that really came up a lot, which I think is really important to understand in terms of fascist development and how they saw themselves, is as you mentioned so clearly, Europe was so divided by class consciousness. Class consciousness was obviously a striving or a major force in the Soviet and the Bolshevik Revolution, which, as a side note, can't be ignored because it's obviously another totalitarian state, but also too because the fascists themselves, Italy and especially Germany, lived in deep reference to the Soviet Union. A lot of what they did and why they justified doing what they did was in relationship and concern over the Soviet Union. And so they saw themselves as continually in some sort of long-term historic battle with the forces of communism. But in that same vein, transferring that sort of class consciousness into a homogenized national consciousness. And like you said, that's obviously directly related to mass movements of the late 19th and early 20th century, you know, because you think about prior aristocracies and stuff like that, you know, conservative, you know, upper echelons, conservative movements had no issues with holding power in extreme minorities. But lo and behold, the 20th century comes along, mass politics becomes a thing, and now conservatives don't feel... It's not even like they don't feel, it's that the conservative movements at the time no longer think in terms of them being able to hold power without popular support. Popular support becomes a necessary grounds for power, for for the state. And this is, we obviously, we kind of already think that way, but that was a relatively new thing at the time. And this really, like, that shift became very clear with, in particular, the Nazis' rise to power, where technically speaking, the conservatives could have made a government without, I don't want to get too much into the actual Nazis'